Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present activist and author Kevin Alexander Gray, who discusses the police shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and the many unaddressed issues of racism and violence that permeate American society. John Devine, senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council, who discusses the origins of the algae bloom on Lake Erie in July that led to a temporary drinking water ban for the residents of Toledo, Ohio. And Greg Leslie of the group Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, who talks about the U.S. Justice Department's prosecution of investigative reporter James Risen and what's at stake for press freedom. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The campaign to repel Islamic State fighters from Iraqi Kurdistan is uniting the interests of the United States and Iran. In recent days, military advisors from the Pentagon in Iran were reported to be aiding the Kurdish Peshmerga army in northern Iraq. At the same time, President Obama and Iran's leaders successfully put pressure on Iraq's embattled Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki to step down in favor of new leadership. Around the Persian Gulf, Saudi Arabia and its Sunni Muslim neighbors remain nervous about Iran's nuclear ambitions. To counter those fears, Iran's newly elected president, Hassan Rouhani, launched a charm offensive calling Saudi Arabia a friend and brother, and recently traveled to Oman and Kuwait. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the recent hostility between Iran and its Sunni Arab neighbors dates back to 1987, when supporters of Iran's revolutionary leader Ayatollah Khomeini sparked riots that killed over 400 people during the Holy Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca. Ever since, Saudi leaders have accused Tehran of creating turmoil in small Shiite communities in the predominantly Sunni Persian Gulf states. With a concerted effort to moderate his nation's policies, President Rouhani is working hard to change perceptions in the Middle East. With the rise of the jihadist Islamic State as a military threat in Iraq, Syria, and the entire region, Shiite Iran is now in a stronger position to improve relations with Gulf states that originally backed the rebels to oust Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Violence erupted in late July in Kashgar, a city on the western edge of China's Xinjiang province, during the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Over 100 people were reported killed in the worst outbreak of ethnic violence in 5 years in western China, but exiles from the Turkish-speaking Uyghur community say the death toll was much higher. A young Uyghur in Kashgar told The Economist magazine, "Many Uyghurs have been arrested in recent months for offenses such as talking to outsiders." In May, Chinese authorities declared a people's war on terrorism in Xinjiang. Police blamed Uyghurs for a brazen attack on government offices with knives and axes. In retaliation, police shot and killed 57 attackers. 2 days later, the chief imam of Kashgar's largest mosque was stabbed to death by Uyghur extremists during morning prayers. Since a 2009 clash between Uyghurs and ethnic Han Chinese that saw 200 killed, Beijing has promoted development and transit projects to connect Xinjiang with the rest of China, while encouraging more Han Chinese to move to the region. But China's enforcement of so-called Project Beauty checkpoints, harassing Uyghur women for wearing traditional veils and men with beards, has instead created resentment and sown tension. Just 10 miles outside of Albuquerque, New Mexico, Pajarito Mesa looks like a town that time forgot. The windswept desert community of 1,200 lacks electric power and most utilities, while many residents live in cinder block houses and trailers. According to the news magazine In These Times, many of the oldest colonias, like Pajarito Mesa, were first settled as railroad labor camps in the late 1800s. These towns are classified by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development as lacking adequate water, sewers, and/or housing. Today, the prospect of cheap land attracts the working poor to Pajarito Mesa, but it's nearly impossible to get a conventional bank mortgage to buy land. Instead, most land transfers are lightly regulated real estate contracts. In 2013, New Mexico legislators attempted to reform real estate contracts. A proposed bill called for full disclosure about the property being sold and use of title insurance, but the legislation died after real estate interests aggressively lobbied to defeat the measure. While the New Mexico Senate studies the problem and advocates argue for regulations that the real estate industry resists, people of Pajarito Mesa still hang on to their version of the American dream, a community where land and housing remains extremely inexpensive, but also a place where environmental and sanitary conditions are deplorable and utilities are almost non-existent. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In the aftermath of the police shooting of Michael Brown that took the life of the unarmed 18-year-old African-American in Ferguson, Missouri, the predominantly black St. Louis suburb exploded in protest and violence. In the weeks since Brown's death, peaceful protests during the day have contrasted with nightly running street battles between riot-clad police and angry crowds defying curfews and throwing rocks, bottles, and Molotov cocktails at state and local law enforcement. Many in the community are infuriated that the police officer involved in the shooting has not yet been charged with murder. The initial militarized local police response to protests in Ferguson that included the deployment of armored vehicles, high-powered rifles, and flash grenades designed for combat was widely criticized as further fueling the conflict. Although Missouri Governor Jay Nixon assigned State Police Captain Ron Johnson, who grew up in Ferguson, to take command of the situation, daily confrontations have continued. Dorian Johnson, a friend of Michael Brown who was with him during the incident, told investigators that Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson chased Brown as he fired a shot that hit him in the back. Then after Brown put his hands up in the air, the witness stated the officer shot him 5 or 6 more times. An independent autopsy requested by the family revealed that Michael Brown was shot 6 times, twice in the head, and provided evidence that appears to contradict some of Johnson's account, as well as Officer Wilson's version of the shooting that alleged the teenager had tried to grab his weapon. Racial profiling of African-American males by police across the U.S. has resulted in dozens of shooting deaths of unarmed black men each year, a decades-long deadly pattern that provokes anger and fear in many black communities. Your reporter spoke with activist and author Kevin Alexander Gray, who examines the murder of Michael Brown in the context of pervasive racism and violence that persists within our nation's criminal justice system and society at large.
Those that follow police practices and the killing of people of color by police or those under the color of law know that every 8 hours a person of color is killed by somebody under the color of law. You know, in the last year that number is getting a lot of play, but the significance is that it happens all the time. Attached to that, why it is that police think that they can just stop black people, and in particular young black males, the excuse that they use most often these days is the drug war. Racial profiling comes out of the war on drugs. That's why we see such a large number of young black males in jail disproportionately. Many people have talked about increased militarization of police departments, the end of community policing, this getting all this military equipment from the Department of Defense, the increase in the number of SWAT teams that police forces have across the country, the influx of soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan and going to police forces. Police use this idea of shoot to kill, where they're the judge, jury, and executioner of people for crimes that if they were adjudicated, most of them might be misdemeanors or felonies, but they certainly wouldn't warrant the death penalty. The over-policing in communities of color and the disrespect that police show people in those communities of color to where, as we've heard in Ferguson, police calling people animals. So, you know, the community outrage because of social media and because so many people witnessed this execution of this young man has led, as in the Trayvon Martin killing, to a focus on this one particular victim. But people are victimized every day, and we have to figure out a way to roll back the kind of power that the police are claiming that's leading us to a police state. I've been writing about this stuff for 20 or 30 years. I first saw my first autopsy of a young man shot by the police. I guess I was in my 20s. So this isn't new. Folk have been killing people, if we talk about people of color, because they thought they could and get away with it, and they have, way beyond Emmett Till.
The violence against black males across the country is almost an endless list, with Amadou Diallo, Abner Louima, Sean Bell, Rodney King, including names like Oscar Grant of the Bay Area, and there are so many others that we don't know about that didn't make the front pages of the newspaper. But I would ask you this, is this a local issue that must be dealt with locally in local police departments and local city halls, or is this a national dialogue that needs to happen in a very different way than it's happened in the past?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been saying all week, America is Ferguson. People need to understand that America is Ferguson. It happens all the time. Now, I mentioned earlier, police organizations go out when these things happen and investigate other police organizations. In the late 80s and 90s, we were talking about citizens' review boards. We need to pick up the baton on that and start demanding that we have citizens' review boards that are independent of these police organizations, independent of politics, that have power, have subpoena power, that we can start investigating these crimes and holding people accountable. And then, of course, on the war on drugs, and especially in the black community with the war on drugs, we have to start talking seriously about drug legalization and decriminalization so that we can take at least that tool away from the police departments that they use to profile young black males.
Kevin, I wanted to ask you this. Despite this horrendous tragedy and the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, is this an opportune moment to push things beyond where they have traditionally been in terms of not getting the heart of police violence towards minority communities? And President Obama certainly is a unique figure in history, being the nation's first black president. Has he done all he can to push these issues forward?
I'm going to answer the last question first, make it very short. President Obama doesn't have any more authority to talk about extrajudicial killing. Every Tuesday he has Terror Tuesday. I mean, and he goes out and uses drones to kill people without due process. He's killed American citizens, not that their lives are more important than the other lives of the people whose names we don't know. In the end, President Obama is going to fall down on the side of law and order, so I really don't give his remarks a whole lot of weight. Now, on the first part of it, we all hope that these kinds of incidents will bring a greater awareness of how the powerful are misusing their power. And there are a lot of people who don't need to be carrying guns. Maybe we need to take away this right to shoot to kill without consequence from police departments. Maybe police don't even need to be carrying guns around all the time. And then maybe our country and our nation and our government, which sets a bad example for everyone that they supposedly rule over, by going to war every 20 years, well, we've killed over 30 million people since World War II. We've got to talk about stopping the violence from the top down and from the bottom up at the same time. And we've got to realize that black people are just as afraid as white people are. And at some point in the time in our history, moving forward, we've got to learn to live together or we're going to perish. That's the way it's going to be. But nobody is going to just take your rights and be able to kill you without consequence. I mentioned it earlier today, the old Negro spiritual that we always sang when we march, before I be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. And either you mean that or you don't.
That was activist and author Kevin Alexander Gray. He's one of three editors of a new book titled Killing Trayvons, an Anthology of American Violence. Find links to more news and commentary on the shooting death of Michael Brown in Ferguson street protests by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Two major drinking water disasters have hit the U.S. so far this year. In January, a chemical used in processing coal, and about which very little is known, poured into the Elk River, which serves as the drinking water supply for 300,000 West Virginians. In July, a toxic algae bloom in Lake Erie led to a temporary drinking water ban in Toledo, Ohio. The two problems have different origins, but they both reflect the fact that what was once a universally provided public good in the U.S., clean, safe water, is now threatened due to lax enforcement of pollution regulations under the Clean Water Act, little protection for tributary streams and wetlands, and poor maintenance of aging water infrastructure. Compounding the problem, lobbyists from several industries have aggressively opposed strengthening government regulations that protect clean water supplies. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with John Devine, senior attorney in the water program of the Natural Resources Defense Council. He says there's a common thread in the interrelationship of our surface waters and our drinking water supply. About 124 million people in the U.S. get their drinking water from surface waters as opposed to less vulnerable underground sources. Here he discusses the specific problem in Toledo, where the algae bloom resulted from nitrogen and phosphorus pollution from agriculture and sewage system runoff, and what can be done about it.
Nitrogen and phosphorus pollution isn't just one problem. It's a bunch. So solving it is going to mean a suite of solutions as well. There are a variety of sources of these pollutants from row crop agriculture, but also industrial livestock operations, urban areas that have storm water runoff that picks up all kinds of stuff and dumps it into our waterways, overflows from aging sewer systems, and sewage treatment plants that have these pollutants in their discharge. So we're going to need to rein in the pollution from all of those sources where they are contributing to these kinds of algae blooms. The good news is we have the tools to reduce the likelihood of these outbreaks, but we need to get over the political opposition that has blocked them so far. One of the most basic things that we can do, and what is the biggest current opportunity in this area, is to move forward on an important proposed federal rule that would better protect tributary streams and wetlands that can serve as natural filters of some of these pollutants, and that can also trap runoff that would otherwise whisk them to our water bodies. But that's been vigorously opposed by discharging industry and by the agriculture industry.
Why do they oppose that?
I don't know. It's a very common sense initiative. It would actually just restore protections to small streams and wetlands that had long been protected prior to a pair of Supreme Court decisions and Bush administration policies in the 2000s. These things are important natural buffers against pollution. They also help provide, in their own right, drinking water to millions of Americans. These small and seasonal and rain-dependent streams support drinking water for 117 million Americans.
John Devine, how much of this problem is related to the poor state of infrastructure in this country?
Aging and aged infrastructure is a big problem. In a number of places, the Great Lakes is one, and New England is another place where they're concentrated, we have sewage systems that carry sewage from people's homes and businesses in the same pipes as runoff from parking lots and streets. Usually, on dry days and small rain days, that goes to a sewage treatment plant. But on days when it's wetter, they are designed to overflow, and so you get a mixture of raw sewage and stormwater going directly into water bodies without treatment. And that can have many of these pollutants that cause algae blooms, but also bacteria and viruses that can make people sick. So dealing with that is a big challenge that cities really need to help do over the next several years, but it's many hundreds of dollars of investment over the next couple decades, according to EPA. And so what we think the best solution to those sewage overflows, to stormwater in urban areas, is to require development to be designed in a way that retains water that would otherwise flow off. So using techniques that we call green infrastructure, things like rain gardens and permeable pavement and green roofs, things that capture water rather than cause it to run off and become pollution.
And those solutions wouldn't be nearly as expensive as replacing all the old water pipes.
They are, in many cases, much more cost-effective, and they have a number of additional benefits for the communities in which they're located. Green solutions like have vegetation that can purify the air, that can reduce urban heat effect, and all kinds of other things. People also just like to live near features like this.
But those old pipes will still need to be replaced, right?
That's true. And it's something that really does need to happen in many cities on a grand scale. Like I said, EPA has estimated that there are many hundreds of billions of dollars of needs on the infrastructure side, both drinking water and wastewater, over the next 20 years. And that's going to take shared effort from all of us who use these systems, but also investing in the kinds of solutions that we talked about that minimize the burden on those systems when they are used.
That was John Devine, senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council's Water Program. For more information on the status of the nation's drinking water supply, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. At an August 14th news conference in Washington, D.C., press freedom organizations rallied together to support New York Times reporter and author James Risen, who faces prosecution for refusing to disclose his sources. In advance of the event, held at the National Press Club, organizers presented a petition to the U.S. Justice Department with more than 100,000 signatures, demanding that the federal government stop its six-year prosecution of Risen. The Obama administration's Department of Justice has ordered Risen to testify against one of his alleged sources, former CIA agent Jeffrey Sterling, who is believed to have provided the reporter with confidential information regarding a failed CIA operation to sabotage Iran's nuclear weapons program, which was published in Risen's 2006 book, State of War. Thus far, Risen has refused to cooperate with prosecutors and identify his source, stating that he would rather go to jail than give up everything he believes in. The government, for its part, asserts that freedom of the press does not permit journalists to refuse to provide direct evidence of criminal wrongdoing by confidential sources. When the Supreme Court refused to hear Risen's appeal, the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter exhausted all his legal options and now faces jail time. The aggressive pursuit of government leaks by the Obama White House has resulted in a doubling of the number of whistleblower investigations under the 1917 Espionage Act than in all previous presidential administrations combined. Your reporter spoke with Greg Leslie, legal defense director with the group Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. Here he discusses what's at stake in Risen's case for press freedom and the urgency for Congress to pass a federal shield law to protect journalists' sources.
Risen's source revealed some major information about what the CIA was up to and the fact that they had tried to give bad information to the Iranian government, but apparently, you know, related to using centrifuges to refine nuclear material. But apparently anyone who really knew that kind of, I don't know if it was the programming language or what, but they could look at it and see what the mistake was, and they fixed it. So we ended up giving very important information to the Iranian government when we were actually trying to track how they were getting it and trying to use bad information. So Risen revealed all this, didn't name his source, obviously. The government is prosecuting Sterling for it, and they just want Risen to say that this was his source, and he's refusing to do that. And we're certainly supporting him in that right. You know, information like that about a major national security crisis and a really bungled job at protecting the nation's secrets needs to be talked about in public. It needs to come to the public's attention. We need to know how our government works. You know, they want to claim that anything related to the national security has to be confidential, and so anyone who reveals it has to be prosecuted. But really, there's an important public dialogue that has to occur anytime there's such a major problem with how the government is operating.
Greg, it might seem obvious to journalists, but maybe explain to our listeners what is of critical importance in protecting sources for an investigative journalist.
Well, you know, it's an age-old tradition that really even predates the Republic. Reporters believe the only way you can really hold the government accountable is to be able to go to people who have this information about those in power and promise them confidentiality. Their lives will change if they don't get that confidentiality. They'll be prosecuted. They'll be fired from their jobs. They'll be denied a lot of basic rights. They really have a lot to lose when they come forward to reveal official wrongdoing. And so the only way you can really get that information into the public dialogue is to promise confidentiality, and you have to take that pledge seriously when you make it, because you're going to face, as a reporter, you're going to face quite a bit of opposition and, you know, quite a threat of punishment for refusing to give up that source. Reporters really believe they have an important reason for doing this, and the government has never agreed that there is such a right not to testify. The funny thing is, on the state level, we've had a lot of success. There are now 40 states that have actual statutes on their books acknowledging a reporter's privilege not to be compelled to testify. But the federal government has never gone that way, and it really is about time for that.
Greg, as I understand it, many of the groups that have come out in defense of James Risen have also called on Congress to pass SHIELD legislation to protect journalists from being forced to reveal their sources. Can you update us on what is pending in Congress, if anything, and the prospects for its passage?
Yeah, we've been fighting for a SHIELD law back since the Judith Miller days, when all that came up and journalists were threatened with going to jail. And then there was the Balco investigation, where San Francisco Chronicle reporters had a threat of going to jail for not revealing their sources. And so the SHIELD law effort was renewed. And back then, in 2007, 2009, the bills passed easily in the House. And it got through the Senate, although the Senate always seems to be more concerned and more hung up on the national security aspects of it. So it was harder to get through the Senate, but it did finally get through the Senate Judiciary Committee in 2009. And then right around that time, we had the whole incident with WikiLeaks and the Bradley Manning disclosures. And members of the Senate were suddenly saying, well, really, who is a journalist? Are we going to have to protect all these people? And so it kind of fell apart at that point. Even a few years later, people realized that, of course, people who are out there getting tips on the internet and putting it on a blog, of course that's doing journalism. It's not the forum you're doing it in, it's the act that you're performing. So we're hopeful. We're thinking this, you know, is about the best time. The stars are aligning just right, hopefully, to get this thing through, but the House is an unknown, and we really don't know yet if the Senate's going to ever bring it to the floor.
That was Greg Leslie, legal defense director with the group Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. For additional information on the James Risen case and what's at stake for press freedom, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.